Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And it's all about full compliance of the Constitution. With all the things going on, I get pulled into these different ancillary issues, debates, and so forth. And one of such is a comment and or debate regarding communism, because communism is here. It's clear they are doing what they can to overthrow us. And folks, as citizens, we are all required to support the Constitution. Ergo, if you choose to attack our government and attack our Constitution, you lose your right to be a citizen. It's one thing to have an opinion, but to actively undermine, subvert, and overthrow our government, that is considered an insurrection. It is considered a rebellion. You become an enemy. And we're all obligated to support and defend the Constitution against its enemies, foreign and domestic. So I don't know how much clearer I can make this. We are immune from communism in America. It can't happen unless we sit on our hands and just watch while we're eating popcorn them take over. I mean, we really have to be that complacent and placid. It's the same thing with Islam. They have no authority to be acting, directing laws, and acting the way they are in America. And folks, the reason why we're in this, the reason why we have so many problems is because you and I, we the people, have failed to hold the standard and hold the line. It is our job to hold people accountable. The fact is, we've been indoctrinated to believe these ideas. Oh, yeah, well, no, we can do anything and everything we want. I mean, it's like that TV show, that annoying TV show where the kids are just making up the rules as they go along and everybody's going along with it going, what are you doing? That's not how you play that game. That's not how you play baseball. That's not how you play football. Anyway, welcome back, Sean. Welcome back, and
good to be back, sir. Thank you.
Yes, folks, we're in the throes of the Virginia debates, and so we are going to keep moving through that. We just read Patrick Henry's little diatribe regarding the militia. And his assertions that, oh, the militia is going to fail. Well, yeah, it'll fail as long as nobody is supporting the Constitution. Nobody. In other words, when the federal government fails to do it, it is the state's job to actually hold them accountable. I've said this before, that when the state is, you know, going out and buying weapons and so forth, they should send requisites to the federal government to say, okay, you owe us this money. We spent this money in buying the armaments and you know, weapons and rounds and so forth that you have prescribed for us to do, because they're the ones who are supposed to pay for it. So when the federal government comes along with their taxes and say, okay, well, we're going to, you know, tax you with this and ignore the fact that they owe you money, then you can turn right around and say, okay, well, we're deducting our tax, what we have to pay you for what you have to pay us. That just nullifies your debt to us. There we go. Done. There are ways of accountability, and the federal government is dependent upon the states. The states are not dependent upon the federal government. And so I hope people start understanding that the parents should not be allowing the child to make up the rules. This is why it's so screwed up. It is so screwed up. It is just, it boggles my mind. How are these things happening? How are we literally poisoning ourselves in our food, in our air, our water? Because they made it up. They said, oh, we got too many people. This is what we're going to do. Anyway. So, again, welcome back, Sean. I'm not sure if you've got any go backs. I'd like to make sure I offer that to you if you've got any.
No, sir.
All right.
Ready to go.
All right. So let's go ahead with, I believe it's Mr. Lee of Westmoreland. Yes, Mr. Lee of Westmoreland.
He tells us that he is a staunch Republican and that he adores liberty. I believe him. And when I do so, I wonder what he should say that a kingly government is superior to that system which we admire. He tells you that it cherishes a standing army and that militia alone ought to be depended upon for the defense of every free country. There is not a gentleman in this house, not even the gentleman himself. There is not a man within these walls who admires the militia more than I do. Without vanity, I may say I have had different experience of their service, okay, from that of the honorable gentleman. It was my fortune to be a soldier of my country. In the discharge of my duty, I knew the worth of militia. I have seen them perform feats that would do honor to the first veterans and submitting to what would daunt German soldiers. I saw what the honorable gentleman did not see, our men fighting with the troops of that king whom he so much admires. I have seen proofs of the wisdom of that paper on your table. I have seen incontrovertible evidence that militia cannot always be relied upon. I could enumerate many instances, but one will suffice. Let the gentleman recollect the action of Guildford. The American regular troops behaved there with the most gallant intrepidity. What did the militia do? The greatest number of them fled. Their abandonment of the regulars occasioned the loss of the field. Had the line been supported that day, Cornwallis, instead of surrendering at Yorktown, would have laid down his arms at Guildford. This plan provides for the public defense as it ought to do. Regulars are to be employed when necessary, and the service of the militia will always be made use of. This, sir, will promote agricultural industry and skill and military discipline and science. I cannot understand the implication of the honorable gentleman that because Congress may arm the militia, the states cannot do it. Nor do I understand the reverse of the proposition. The states are by no part of the plan before you precluded from arming and disciplining the militia. Should Congress neglect it? In the course of Saturday and some previous harangues from the terms in which some of the northern states were spoken of, one would have thought that the love of an American was in some degree criminal, as being incompatible with a proper degree of affection for a Virginian. The people of America, sir, are one people. I love the people of the North, not because they have adopted the Constitution, but because I fought with them as my countrymen, and because I consider them as such. Does it follow from hence that I have forgotten my attachment to my native state? In all local matters, I shall be a Virginian. In those of a general nature, I should not forget that I am an American.
Okay, so one of the things that that gets lost in everybody's mind is the idea of what they had under the Articles of Association and what they had under the Constitution. The Articles of Association and the Articles of Confederation basically gave Congress really no power to create an army, but they did it anyway. They created the Marine Corps, Navy, and so forth under the Association, because the whole point was that they were going to take economic positions. They were going to take economic measures to fight back with Britain. And so they saw no need to establish an army or what have you. And so when all of a sudden the British in, what was it, early 74, early 75, in response to the petition of the Articles of Association, King George said, okay, well, you want to take economic measures? I'll take military measures over that. And it forced the hand. They had to do something, so they responded. But at that point, at no time did they have the ability to actually take the militia as ownership. What they had to do was they actually had to create and obtain funding and then use that money, because one way or the other, in the Articles of Confederation, they either had to bill the states for the things that they needed to do, and or they had to put requisitions against the states to provide for the manning, for the militia, for the army, and so forth. So they went down the path of doing both, and they used both regulars in creating a separate private or a mercenary army under Washington. And if I remember correctly, that it really galvanized in that first winter in Valley Forge. Is that not correct? That army? Because the militias went home in the wintertime. And what stayed behind were those men that became a part of that regular army. And that right there was, I will say, a really turning point in the military capabilities of the United States. Nevertheless, there was no ability for the Articles of Association to basically put a requisition and say, you will give us troops for 2 years, or you'll give us troops, for this cause, and we may have to extend it and extend it and extend it as necessary, but that extension will be based on 2 years at a time. And the reason it was done that way is to ensure that the people at any point in time could stop the madness if the war became this self-licking ice cream cone. In other words, this mechanism of, extending power and so forth. So the Constitution offered something completely different. It actually empowered the federal government to, one, form an army by calling forth the militia and federalizing them for 2 years, or for whatever the purpose or cause was. It all depended on three things. The Constitution gives them the power to call forth the militia to federalize for an army for execution of the laws, suppressing insurrections, or repelling invasions. And each case may require just, a couple months, or each case may require, or one case may require both, whatever. It's a case-by-case situation based on the magnitude of the problem. If we're really being overran and the British keep coming, that means that we're going to be suppressing, this invasion, or basically repelling an invasion for 2, 4, 5, however long the invasion goes. And so it gave them the ability to actually create that standing army for the time period necessary, not for permanency. Does that make sense, Sean?
Yes, sir.
And so they didn't have that at all in the Articles of Confederation. And they didn't have the restriction on the federal government from being able to create a standing army. Or I should say the general government, which is what Washington did. Now they actually have the ability to do it, the mechanism of how to do it, and the mechanism, or the, I'll call it a check or safeguard, to say they can only do it based on funding cycles of 2 years at a time. In other words, we're looking at a mechanism of forming I'll call it a home security force, a home security army, not the global navy. Not the global Navy and Marine Corps that could go and to be funded and functioning from the beginning of this nation to today. No sunsetting, no, contingencies on, funding. They are to be funded. It's only the home defense where there should be funding. 2 years limitation on funding. Does that make sense? Okay, the regular maintenance of the Navy is to be funded every 2 years. Every 2 years. That's a requirement. They have to do that. But they don't have to have an army. They don't have to have the Air Force. They don't have to have this homeland defense. They don't. If we're in peace, and there were points in time where we didn't, well, I have to retract that, because the War Department did everything they could to constantly maintain their staff. Everything they could. They came up with justifications because of the Indian Wars and all these other things. In other words, in some cases, you know, going into peace talks and actually making peace became antithetical to the needs of keeping people employed. This is why, and this is how it became an obvious, the way the U.S. military ignored the Constitution, I should say the Department of Defense, and more specifically, the Department of the Army, and then later on, the creation of the Department of Air Force, they ignored the Constitution. And we allowed this to happen. So it goes back to we the people and us, how we are failing to hold them accountable. But this whole argument right here, what they're talking about, is the fact that, you know, with Mr. Westmoreland, Mr. Lee of Westmoreland, what he's talking about is he was talking about, you know, functioning as a part of that federalized army. It doesn't mean that they can't have a federalized army. Congress has to call them forth, and they have to do so by the requisition of funding. And in so doing, now they can have and do have a regular army that will function for the cause necessary. That's it. But to maintain the army was not necessary, because the one thing that they were maintaining was the Navy. That was our strategic defense from all things external. One would think that once you've taken care of your neighbors and your neighbors know not to, you know, not to reach, you know, try to grab food off your plate, they get their hands slapped enough, they don't do that anymore. Okay, well, but the Navy was to keep any uprising country, Germany or whatever, from, you know, having the temptation of trying to come across and say, you know, we want your resources, we want to invade you. That was their job. That's the Navy's job. That's the Navy and Marine Corps' job, is to protect us from all things external of the United States. In other words, from space, from the water, you know, from our bordering nations, what have you. So when we look at what he's talking about, you know, how he saw things a lot differently, of the need for this. What Henry was pointing out was he wanted to maintain a militia where the federal government would not have the ability to control it. Now, this is the crux of the matter. Mason's the same way. Mason wanted the states to have far more control instead of allowing the federal government to actually federalize them and have full control. So we're going to see these arguments coming in where they're going to complain about, you know, federalizing the militia and then deploying them states away. And they're going to come, and Mason's going to make these assertions. Look, they're going to deploy them, you know, to the ends of the earth. And it will be clarified, no, they can only deploy them to, you know, within the United States, to where the insurrection is, to where the invasion is, or to where the enforcement of law is necessary. And they're not going to go out of their way to, you know, create greater hardship, because it would just cost more money. If the neighboring states can actually manage the matter, the neighboring states would manage the matter. They will have to utilize the resources that would be best, but it wouldn't be the most, I got to be honest, not that I'm lying, but as I think of this, I hate to use that word, as I think of this, I do see that down the road you could have an evildoer, a nefarious man, that is trying to play manipulative games in creating hardships, in trying to create these types of hardships that would give specific outcomes. Because when you put pressure on the people, when you put pressure on the states to say, you know, we need to do this, and or they create the circumstances so that they get away with doing it, and then everybody goes, you know what, that works so well, let's just, you know, let you do that without having to go through the Constitution. In other words, this is where they start, where we start allowing them to bend the laws, and again, this goes back to us. We should never let them bend a law. We should never let them, if the justification for change is there, then we should justify it and allow the change to occur instead of just letting them bend and ignore the law. So this is why we have such problems and such unconstitutional spending and unconstitutional use of our military today, is because they've just constantly been soaking the wood, bending it, and putting it and bending it into the directions that they want. So anyway, hopefully that makes sense. Hopefully it makes sense to the point where we see that the anti-federalist points are they didn't want the federal government to have this kind of power over the military. And that's one of the reasons why they demanded the Second Amendment. So they wanted to make sure that the men would be armed. Well, the reality is the militias were to be armed. Now, if all men were to be armed, that's fine if you want to buy your own arms. But the federal government's responsibility was to fund what? The militia. Those men that were basically in the point of service. This is why I go back and say that every student in school should be trained and should be equipped by the time they graduate with their TO weapon. That way, you know, they have a sidearm, a 9mm, 38, whatever the going round is of the time. And that way, everybody has a sidearm. They're competent. They already have the training necessary, because right now, we have a bunch of, you know, literally drooling, babbling babies coming out of school that are incapable of any discipline at all in functioning, in serving this nation to the capacity that they're obligated to serve. And that's a huge problem, folks, a huge problem. And instead of buying bullets, they're paying to create babbling babies. You see my point?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Every day.
And it's a huge problem. All right. So now Mr. Lee of Westmoreland starts talking about enumerations and then goes into enumerated power. So let's hit these two points he makes.
I say that this new system shows, in stronger terms than words could declare, that the liberties of the people are secure. It goes on the principle that all power is in the people and that rulers have no powers but what are enumerated in that paper. When a question arises with respect to the legality of any power exercised or assumed by Congress, it is plain on the side of the governed. Is it enumerated in the Constitution? If it be, it is legal and just. It is otherwise arbitrary and unconstitutional. Candor must confess that it is infinitely more attentive to the liberties of the people than any state government.
Okay, so right there we're going to be going into a break in less than a minute. But this is one of those very short and concise points of basically laying it out that is it enumerated in the Constitution? If it be, it is legal and just. It is otherwise arbitrary and unconstitutional. Folks, if your state government is doing something like creating a minimum wage that is not legal and just in your Constitution, because it's not there, it's not in the U.S. Constitution or your state Constitution, how is that just? It's arbitrary and unconstitutional. So how are you being secured when they're able to wage actual warfare tactics by making the cost of living and by mandating labor to be set at certain? It's the same thing with rent. And look at how the suffering of this nation has occurred throughout the past century plus as government has tried to create ceilings and floors of cost for things. Are you kidding me? That's all arbitrary. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so now they kind of paraphrase what Mr. Lee kind of surmises. So let's go ahead and go through this paraphrasing. And I don't know why every once in a while this occurs, because I think maybe somebody was supposed to catch it, but they didn't. And later on, they go, hey, what happened here? Oh, I couldn't do this. So they have to sit down and kind of agree with what was asserted. And actually, at the end of each day and then at the end of the debates, the delegation certified the notes or these records of the of the debates. They went in and they looked, they all read them, and any disputes or what have you were brought forward and they were resolved. It's the same thing with the notes on the Constitutional Convention. It was later on done, and unfortunately they were in such a hurry to get out of town. It didn't come forward until Madison's notes came forward and all these other notes. After the Constitution was ratified, they started compiling the notes, and that's when they went through, I think it's William Jackson's notes. They went through Madison's notes, Yates, all these different notes that were coming forth that people took on either a given day or, you know, throughout their discourse, what have you. So anyway, there were points that were actually brought up in reviewing the notes on the convention, where Jackson had to make actual sign off on corrections that he had to make based on what Madison wrote down. There were like two or three specific things that I know he had to sign off on to say, yes, you know, that's what it was, and insert those changes. Because Madison's notes were more thorough on the content. Jackson was more thorough on the procedures, like, you know, who voted how and so forth. And come to find out, Madison took and injected those voting records of Jackson's into his. So, I mean, they went through detailed, you know, scrutiny when it came to these notes. And so this is why you can kind of, every once in a while, you'll find a body where, wow, this is like more of a summation. So let's go through the summation. Go ahead.
Mr. Lee then said that under the state governments, the people reserved to themselves certain enumerated rights, and that the rest were vested in their rulers, that consequently, the powers reserved to the people were but an inconsiderable exception for what were given to their rulers, but that in the federal government, the rulers of the people were vested with certain defined powers, and that what were not delegated to those rulers were retained by the people. The consequence of this, he said, was that their limited powers were only an exception to those which rested in the people, and that they knew what they had given up and could be in no danger. He exemplified the proposition in a familiar manner. He observed that if a man delegated certain powers to an agent, it would be an insult upon common sense to suppose that the agent could legally transact any business for his principal which was not contained in the commission whereby the powers were delegated, but that if a man empowered his representative or agent to transact all his business except certain enumerated parts, the clear result was that the agent could lawfully transact every possible part of his principal's business except the enumerated parts, and added that these plain propositions were sufficient to demonstrate the inutility and folly, where he permitted to use the expression, of bills of rights.
Okay.
I agree.
So, yes. So, now we jump down to Governor Randolph. And Governor Randolph basically goes back to Henry making, again, they were supposed to go through this line by line, right? And they're like in the very first couple days, and they're already now going through Section 8, the very last power granted in Article 1, Section 8, when they haven't even read that far. They hadn't even really gotten that far. And so Mr. Randolph kind of addresses something that Henry talks about regarding the exclusive legislation for Congress over the District of Columbia. And so, folks, as we go through this, because we're going to cover this into a certain degree, keep in mind what they're saying. They're laying it out that this land where the federal government is to sit as a vestige for them to serve the states shall never be a state. The paradigm was cast. The die was cast. It was not to be a state. It was under their control, and they were not to be a state either. They were not to be a party of the compact. They weren't. They were a creature of the compact, but they were given autonomy to protect themselves from the states, not to elevate themselves to being a state. Okay, and as we go through this, think in your head where we are today, because D.C. is creeping closer and closer to becoming a state. I mean, they've already got representation. It's not necessarily voting and so forth, but they're getting there, and they've actually pursued amendments to become the 51st state. That is antithetical to the whole paradigm of having an exclusive and a separate, I'll just call it, a service government, a general government. You give the, you place them in the foothold of becoming a state, then what's to keep that state from annexing Virginia and Maryland? Annexing the entire Eastern Seaboard. Now it's a huge state. Now it's the defining state. You see my point? Who did that just not too long ago in recent history? Maybe some people are still alive that might remember that.
Did what?
Annexed, you know, states. In other words, they basically went in and how do you call it? I should call it annexing, but came in and basically conquered a neighboring state. Let's say Austria, France, you know, where they said, you know, You're an autonomous state, but we need you, and we're going to annex you. And they took over. They just rolled their tanks in and took over. That's what Hitler did. And, you know, at the very beginning, it seemed, oh, well, you know, they're part of the Germanic states, you know, Austria. That's not a big deal. But when it hit France, it became a bigger deal. Go ahead, let's read what Governor Randolph says here.
I beg the honorable gentleman to pardon me for reminding him that his historical references and quotations are not accurate. If he errs so much with respect to his facts as he has done in history, We cannot depend on his information or assertions. He had, early in the debates, instanced Holland as a happy democracy, highly worthy of our imitation. From thence he went over the mountains to Switzerland to find another democracy. He represented all those cantons as being of the democratic kind. I wish he had reflected a little more and distinguished those that are democratical from those which are aristocratical. He has already been reminded of his errors. I should not now put him right with respect to history had he not continued his mistakes. Consult all writers, from Sir William Temple to those of modern times. They will inform you that the Republic of Holland is an aristocracy. He is inveighed against the stadtholder. I do not understand his application of this to the American president. It is well known that but for the stadtholder, the Republic would have been ruined long ago. Holland, it seems, has no 10 miles square, but she has The Hague, where the deputies of the states assemble. It has been found necessary to have a fixed place of meeting, but the influence which it has given the province of Holland to have the seat of government within its territory, subject in some respects to its control, has been injurious to the other provinces. The wisdom of the convention is therefore manifest in granting the Congress exclusive jurisdiction over the place of their session. I am going to correct a still greater error which he has committed, not in order to show any little knowledge of history I have, for I am by no means satisfied with its extent, but to endeavor to prevent any impressions from being made by improper and mistaken representations.
And, you know, it's worthy to say, this is where he goes in and says, he said that the Magna Carta destroyed all implication. This was not the object of the Magna Carta, but to destroy the power of the king and secure the liberty of the people. The Bill of Rights was intended to restore the government to its primitive principles. So he keeps on going on. Folks, you really need to read, you know, these entire debates, because they really, really have a lot of meat. We're only getting highlights for you. So as we go down the next day, because they run out of time, believe it or not, as Mr. Randolph kind of just wraps up here, lo and behold, they start off the next day with Mr. Randolph continuing on. So Governor Randolph then continues and talks about the interposition of the president not to have a council. So let's go ahead with that part right there.
He observed that the only question was, with respect to previous and subsequent amendments, were this the only question, sir, I am sure this inconsiderable matter would not long retard a decision. I conceive the preservation of the Union to be a question of great magnitude. This must be a peculiar object of my attention. Unless I depart from that rule which has regulated my conduct since the introduction of federal measures. Suppose, contrary to my expectation, this convention should propose certain amendments previous to its ratification. Mild and pliant as those states may be who have received it unanimously, flexible as those may be who have adopted it by a majority, I had rather argue from human nature that they will not recede from their resolutions to accommodate our caprice. Is there no jealousy existing between the states? They discover no superiority in any one state of arrogating itself to a fight to dictate what ought to be done. They would not see the reasons of such amendments, for some amendments in themselves are really dangerous. The same reasons could not be impressed on all the states. I shall mention one example. I shall suppose, for instance, that we shall propose as an amendment that the president shall have a council. I conceive a council to be injurious to the executive. The counselors will either impede or clog the president, or, if he be a man of dexterity, they will be governed by him. They will also impair his responsibility. Is it probable that all the other states would think alike on the subject or agree to such an alteration? As there is a mode in the Constitution itself to procure amendments, not by reference to the people, but by the interposition of the state legislatures. Will the people of Virginia bind themselves not to enter the Union till amendments shall have been obtained? I refer to any gentleman here whether this may or not entirely exclude us from the Union.
Okay. Now he actually starts talking about new states with Vermont, New York, and Connecticut regarding Vermont. The, you know, the little intrigue between those two states. It's kind of interesting because, and let me just take an aside real quick, because I had a, I'll call it a historian, challenged me on the fact, because this historian has put it in his book that the every state in the Union became bicameral in mode by the U.S. Constitution. Now, we've already read through where these, in the debates, they have identified how each of the states were differently configured, some bicameral, some not bicameral. I mean, if we're talking about the ratification debates, in other words, the next step, you know, they're forming the government. They're, if you look at the state constitutions, at that point in time, no state reconfigured itself while the U.S. Constitution was being debated. No state did. The only state that was really in flux that I know of was Rhode Island. And that's just due to the fact that Rhode Island was just literally becoming very desperate and grabbing and trying to not pay debt and to, you know, try to not serve justice. They, you know, they canceled their courts, so forth and so on. But when we look at the debates, and if we even go back to the notes on the Constitution Convention, this was constantly being viewed as a whole new form, a whole new paradigm of government. As the states were looking at it, they're going, this is a completely different government. This is not the government that we have. And yet, this historian is citing himself as one telling us that, oh, this, you know, all the states were like this. You know, in other words, the assertion is being made, folks, unsupportedly, because there's no evidence that the Constitution was modeled after the states. Sorry. The Constitution created a brand new paradigm, which basically lent to a lent to the idea of extending a multi-tiered Republican form of government instead of a singular Republican form of government. And so so as we look at this, we're going to start seeing more of these types of things where they're identifying, you know, these concepts of, one, admitting new states into the Union, how they're going to do it, because in this particular case, and I will assert that the original 13 states were quagmires. That's why they were all messed up, because they were started with charters under the king. And back in the 1600s when they started, they had no idea that they would end up in this situation. And so maybe what they should have done, maybe, is when the king started dismissing their government, or maybe after the end of the war, every state should have reconfigured itself into, you know, what it, and technically it kind of did. But not one state came even close to creating a government with three branches of government, with, you know, a branch representing the states, or the state government, a branch, or I should say, a legislative body representing the counties, and then a representative body representing the people of the counties, like the U.S. Constitution. These were all new paradigms, all new. There's a lot of really, really, as people are recognizing that we need to understand this, don't take a fool's understanding, because these types of concepts are foolish and unsupported. When you can actually see these men in the ratification debates are pointing out how disparate each of the states are. They're nothing like each other. And this goes to what I'm asserting. The federal government was never designed to get into the knickers of how we, the people, and our states were to govern ourselves. This is the whole concept of why it was a hybrid constitutional republic, creating a republic at a national level of very limited powers. And then at the state level, it would have its own limitations of powers. And then ultimately, as we saw government grow, we now need to create and or institute and take control of our local government so that we can have it, by the consent of the governed, govern us the way we want and the way we see fit, which means that we would have to redo the state constitutions as well to basically place the state government more into a general mode like the U.S. Constitution with very limited and defined powers. So with that, let me let you go ahead and dive into this next one. Thank you so much.
The honorable gentleman told us that Maryland held out and that there can be no danger from our holding out of the Union, that she refused to come into the Confederation until the year 1781 when she was pressed by the then Congress. Is this a proper comparison? The fear of the British Army and Navy kept the states together. This fear induced that state to come into the Union then. Otherwise, the Union would have been destroyed. We are also told that Vermont held out. His information is inaccurate. Pardon me for saying that it is not to be found in the history of those times. The right to that territory was long in dispute between New York and Connecticut. The inhabitants took that opportunity of erecting themselves into a state. They pressed Congress for admission into the Union. Their solicitations were continually opposed until the year 1781, when a kind of assent was given. Can it be said from this that the people of Vermont held out against a confederation of 12 states? Were they sufficiently wealthy and numerous to do so? Virginia is said to be able to stand by herself. From her situation, she has caused a fear. She has also caused a fear from her inability to raise an army, a navy, or money. I contend that she is not able to stand by herself. I am sure that every man who comes from the exposed parts of this country is well convinced of this truth. As these have been enumerated, it would be useless to go over them again. He then told us that an error in government never can be removed. I will acknowledge with him that there are governments in Europe whereof the defects have a long time been unaltered and are not easily changed.
Okay, so now he moves back into another point that he wants to make. So these are just long, I'll say orations where he goes through these different points and so forth. And I'll tell you what, Governor Randolph is a very fitting debater. I mean, he covers, if you look at how many pages he covers when he gets up and talks and covers these different issues. And in some cases, he's not as succinct, and then sometimes he is. So here he talks again a little bit further down in this same diatribe about the militia. And so let's go into that part of this diatribe. Go ahead.
Another construction he gives is that it is exclusively in the power of Congress to arm the militia, and the states could not do it if Congress thought proper to neglect it. I'm astonished how this idea could enter into the gentleman's mind, whose acuteness no man doubts. How can this be fairly deduced from the following clause? Quote, to provide for the organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in service of the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia, according to the discipline prescribed by Congress, end quote. He complains much of the implication, but in this case, he has made use of it himself, for his construction of this clause cannot possibly be supported without it. It is clear and self-evident that the pretended danger cannot result from the clause. Should Congress neglect to arm or discipline the militia, the states are fully possessed of the power of doing it, for they are restrained from it by no part of the Constitution.
And in addition, because Congress is supposed to do it, they can put requisitions back to the federal government to say, we have done this per the Constitution, and since it is your responsibility to pay for it, here's the bill. It doesn't mean that they can't bill Congress for it. It's if it's their duty to provide for the arming, then it's their, the state can go do it and then turn right around. And then when the federal government comes along and says, well, we want, you know, this money in taxes. Okay. Well, we owe you that money in taxes because that's legitimate. And you owe us this money in arming, which is equally legitimate. We will deduct that from the taxes we owe you. You see my point?
Yes, sir.
But they're trying to make hay out of, you know, oh, well, the literal implication is that it's not listed there that they can't do it. Well, it's not listed there that they can or can't, but later on in the Bill of Rights that the necessity of a militia is, you know, paramount to the security of any nation or state, you know, that the right of men to be armed, you know, shall not be infringed. So anyway, let's move forward with the common defense and welfare comment here.
Are you sure we have time for that?
You know what? I think you could read it really fast, but technically this is kind of an important point because at the very, very bottom, this is where he lays out in a kind of a succinct mode how the federal government has no general powers delegated to it. When people look at the preamble of Section 8, they presume that that preamble is granting general powers when it's not. It's a preamble that is explaining why the following powers are being granted. It is not a specific granting of powers. It is an explanation of why these powers, you know, the taxation powers are possessed by the government for the execution of the following powers. And so, and that is for the common defense and general welfare, those following powers are being delegated. So anyway, we will pick that up when we come back. Any other comments?
No, sir.
All right. Well, shoot, I don't know what to say. I mean, I'm usually at a loss of words when I got a couple seconds. But folks, I'm hoping that going through this treasure trove of facts of how the Constitution was laid out and defined, as we're almost through, we're wrapping up. Virginia's, you know, then North Carolina, we're done. So I'm hoping that you're starting to, you've had more than enough information and facts given you so that you can see how this Constitution was not lightly defined. It was debated and it was clarified, especially in the six states that vigorously debated. And thank God they did, and they documented it. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.